Welcome to Skype for Business Subject Matter Expert, or SME Roundtable. Hi, I'm Sherry Battine, and I'll be your host today. We are the IT Showcase team, and we love to talk to you, our customers, about how Microsoft does IT. I'm here with many of our IT experts that are here to talk to you about how we run Skype for Business at Microsoft. This is your opportunity to ask direct questions of our SMEs and receive candid answers. We would like to learn a little bit about you also. We are posting a question in the window about where you are on your deployment to the cloud for your Skype for Business. With that, the answers, we'll be able to know where you stand so that we can tailor our answers to that. So with that, we will make every effort in the next hour to answer all of your questions. However, if we don't, we'll stay behind in the studio and continue answering questions and post that extended footage along with this video on Microsoft.com/IT Showcase. With that, I'd like to ask our SMEs to introduce themselves and start with Casey.
Hi. I'm Casey Han. I'm Skype for Business Service Engineer, managing SIP trunking, session border controllers, and gateways.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Lewis. I'm a senior IT service manager on the voice, video, and conferencing team with a focus on Skype for Business.
Hello, I'm Donna Patterson, engineering program manager for Skype for Business client IAM in Presence.
Hi, I'm Kevin Fantom, a service engineer for video and conferencing in the Skype space.
Hello, I'm Dwight Jones. I am a senior service manager for Skype for Business, and I also support problem management for Skype for Business.
Hello, Shin Kudara. I'm the service engineer for Skype for Business, mainly concentrating on PSTN connectivity and user devices and also the problem management piece.
Okay, with that, we'll get started with our first question. Please start submitting your questions through email today, and the questions will be funneled to me on this laptop. So anytime, post your questions. We'll start with our first question to Dwight. What's next for Skype for Business and the hybrid deployment?
Okay, thank you. That's a great question. We're actually moving not only from a hybrid scenario, which we're supporting today, but we're looking to move our users to the full cloud or E5 deployment within Microsoft. One of the big key milestones that we just surpassed here at Microsoft within the last 30 days was a multinational corporation, which allows us to have a multinational cloud. And we've deployed, we have 16,000 users in the full E5 cloud and our North America cloud. And we just deployed our first set of users. We have 200 plus users today in our EMEA cloud. So that multinational cloud environment is where we're going. So we're leading in that space so that companies that do cross oceans can also have a multinational cloud as well.
All right, great. Next question to you, Jonathan. How does Microsoft IT measure user sentiment for Skype for Business?
Yeah, that's a huge focus for us this year in particular. We have multiple ways that we do it because we want to, get different types of feedback from different types of users. So basically, we have everything from twice a year. We do what we call our global employee satisfaction survey. It goes out twice a year to a subset of our users, not to every user. But it takes a while to compile that data because there's a whole lot of data and verbatims that come back from it. So we also have some other mechanisms that we use, something called user voice. We have an internal deployment of user voice specifically for Skype for Business, in which users can go out and say things like, I'd really like to see this feature in Skype for Business, and then other people can actually read that and vote on it. So what that gives us is if we get hundreds and hundreds of votes, then we can go to the product group and say, hey, look, we should probably pay attention to this feature because a lot of users are wanting it. We've also doing these shorter surveys, a little shorter than the bi-yearly surveys. They're called monthly pulse. That's trying to get us a little bit more agile, and a little bit more leading indicators versus the lagging indicators we tend to get out of the twice a year. type of scenario. And we also have something called Rate My Call. So after a user gets done with a call, they get a pop-up, and they can actually rate that call from 1 to 5, 1 being worst, 5 being great. And they can also give us some verbatim feedback, which we actually mine pretty heavily to figure out. I get more out of the verbatims, to be perfectly honest. The numbers are what they are, but the verbatims are where I kind of get those nuggets of wisdom. So those are really the primary methods that we use. We've also been doing actually a huge effort of user outreach, in which the subject matter experts will travel to our sites. We've kind of covered North America, and now we're moving out to EMEA and Asia, and actually get with our users and say and really give them the opportunity to say, here's how I'm using the technology, here's my issues, here's the things I'd like to see, and we take that information back to the product group, and they use that to improve the product. So we use a lot of different mechanisms to make sure we have good sentiment.
You may want to mention to them Yammer too, that we use.
Yes, that's true. We do have Yammer as well, and we have people who actually monitor that, and sometimes we as subject matter experts will monitor it. I know there was an hour session that Dwight did and an hour session that I did and maybe others, in which we made ourselves available, and they could come and ask any question they wanted in Yammer, and we would answer them quickly. So yeah, that's another good avenue.
Yeah.
Do we also track sentiment analysis on social channels?
Yes, yeah, we do have some data scientists that help us mine the information that from the various social channels. It's something called Gestalt. It's a tool we use internally, and it really allows us to see what people are talking about, because there's a whole bunch of Yammer channels out there, and we can't monitor all of them. Mm-hmm. There's just too many, but it pulls all that information in and kind of gives us the sentiment there.
Very good. We'll go over to Shin next with how does Microsoft manage least cost routing?
Yes, so we have a lot of questions being asked for the least cost routing in the past from the customers. So for Microsoft, currently we do not do any of the least cost routing. It's basically we deploy a voice media gateway or an SBC to every single location, and all the calls that go in and out to the PSTN uses that homed media gateway. Now, the reason why we don't do this is, one, of course, that there are a lot of regulatory reasons depending on each of the country, but more than that, right now how the Microsoft company is structured, we have different company codes for each of the country, and each of those companies are responsible to pay for their phone usages. So let's say if we do deploy the least cost routing, anybody in the world trying to call a US number, all those outgoing calls will be charged to the U.S. company code, and that makes a very, very complex financial, adjustment. So that is one of the huge reasons. As of today, Microsoft does not do any of the least cost routing.
Okay, thank you. Is there a way to disable video for Skype for Business but allow messaging?
Yes. There you can, within policies, disable video.
And then also, is there a way to throttle the video if you do allow it?
Yes. Within policies, you limit the bandwidth for, you can limit it on video or app sharing. We don't do anything with the signaling component.
Kevin, is it done through client policies or server-side?
This is done through the server side.
Server side.
Yes.
Okay. Next for Donna. Is it better to hard code your IP addresses when federating with Microsoft?
No is the short answer. We have roughly over 18,000 federated partners, and last October we transitioned to a more cloud or O365 practice where we no longer have static IPs, we're more dynamic. And so if you do hard code your IP addresses, when we make those transitions, those changes, and we update or upgrade our infrastructure, you will lose your federation with us, and that could prevent your service from working. So in the short answer, no, you wanna use dynamic and IP addresses, and definitely not hard code them.
Okay, great. great. Next question for Casey. Is it impossible to capture logs in real-time calls from front-end servers? Oh, sorry. It's impossible to capture logs in real-time calls from front-end servers. How do you monitor or troubleshoot real-time calls via SIP trunks? Okay.
So when we are used to using gateways, used to be call comes to the gateway is limited to like up to like 100 calls. Now we move to SIP trunking. We are getting more than 1,000 calls. And to capture the log from that 1,000 calls and focusing just one phone number is really hard to do it. So we have to rely on third-party solutions. There's a lot of third-party software available, but in Microsoft, we decide to use a program called WinIQ. The reason we use WinIQ software is because one of our carriers is using it, and we decide to like look at it, and turns out it does a really good job on it. So we decide to buy their software and implement it in Microsoft. And what their software does is like we can filter into like any text string, like IP address or telephone numbers, and we can see that one call at a time, and we can see whether a call is coming through carrier, whether a call is going to our carrier, and we get a lot of details on that one, including like call qualities. So it's really good tools.
Kind of adding on to that, how we do that is that we do install the WinIQ software onto Windows Server, and then we have the port mirroring in place. A mirror of the port which is connected to the SBC, then the same traffic goes into that mirrored port onto that WinIQ server. So that's how we capture all the real-time calls.
And another reason I said is like a front-end servers, if you're just trying to capture the like 1 minute of our current Microsoft calls, it's more than gig. And from that gig, we have like lot of call volumes, and there's no way to really search through just one number. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of time using this real time, so we can just troubleshoot it within like almost in real time.
Yeah, sounds great. That's a lot of data.
Yep.
Next question. Can I search or talk with my Skype consumer contacts? Donna?
Yes. Skype for Business has interoperability now with Skype Consumer. So if you are an individual who has a Skype Consumer account as well as your Skype for Business, or you want to reach out to a family member, you can go in and search their Skype alias, pull up, and have a Skype chat with them or a Skype call with them. Now, realizing because it is Skype Consumer that you're interfacing with, you do not have the richness of the calls from the Skype Consumer end of Skype for Business. But yes, we have an integrated Skype contact that you can go out and search publicly.
Very good. So no longer do you have to keep business on the business side?
And your personal is on the personal side. You can actually pull in and grab it.
Great. Dwight, this one's for you. What are some improvement areas in the Skype Get to Green service improvements? So I think that's a project you worked on.
Yes, so just to give a little background, the Get to Green effort was based on a huge collaboration across Microsoft with the Skype for Business stakeholders, focused on improving our user experience at the bottom line. And where we started were basically seven pillars of improvement areas. We drove improvements on the server and network infrastructure, dealing with challenges that we had from server capacity as well as network capacity. We're also driving, from a network perspective, Wi-Fi improvements, because there are a lot of changes from the way users use the Wi-Fi infrastructure with BYOD versus the link days when everyone plugged into the wired network infrastructure. So that's one pillar. We also had a client stability pillar, a conference or meeting room pillars, how we were going to drive improvements there. Incident and change management, how we collaborated across Microsoft for driving improvements for incident and changes and now problems into our environment. Dog food or the way that we deploy or what generally would be known as release management, that was a pillar for driving release management, and John can speak to the rings of validations that came out of that. And we also had a communications pillar on how we approached our users and a lot of the sentiment work, a lot of the communication work that Donna's led has come out of that as well. So those are the pillars of service improvement that made up that Get to Green effort, and you know, that has spun a lot of the improvements and that we've seen in the product, and some of those improvements, you know, we went a huge poor call rate improvement for Microsoft to where our PCR rate now is below 2% globally. You know, a lot of network changes in the way that we are, you know, deploying Wi-Fi for our business. We had and just to bring it to a close, from a user perspective, and a huge output of that Get to Green effort is that global employee satisfaction survey that Jonathan mentioned. We had an 18-point improvement over the last fiscal year. So the users are seeing the benefits from that service improvement, the benefits from Skype for Business, and the benefit from the cloud migration, frankly. So,
during that effort, what would you consider your biggest challenge? What was
the biggest challenges were really changing our mindset from a traditional IT mindset to really understanding that we need to provide capabilities to our end users. The difference in Microsoft's deployment of Skype for Business is that Skype for Business is a product for us. It's not only our unified communications platform. So our product group is focused on the futures, and we are what we call dog fooding or releasing new bits into our production environment while we at the same time have to make our production environment healthy for our end users and add on that drive to the cloud. So being able to manage the user experience, the health of our environment, and the futures of the product all simultaneously represent the huge challenges that we have as service managers, as engineers, and as program leads here. And so that's probably the hugest challenge that we deal with, not only then, but on a day-to-day basis as we are trying to go to the next version of the product.
Okay, great. How do you handle the external factors, such as users using their cell phone or home network connection? When they have issues in this area, end users will still blame the Skype service experience.
Yeah.
Let me attempt to take that, and then I'll kick it over to Kevin. Mm-hmm. What we normally do when we have end users issues and they report it either through the Global Help Desk or to Yammer, we work with them and partner with them to help them understand and isolate their issue, whether it is an application truly Skype for Business, or is it a network, is it a capability, or if they're even using the right application and equipment. So once we, whether it's our Global Help Desk or some escalation that we may even get internally or through Yammer, we equipped our end users with how to do a speed test, how to understand pre-call diagnostics, and then also how to set up their work environment that it is conducive to have that call. For example, the distance they are from a microwave, or how many components they may have plugged in using that same line. If you think of anything like the network, it's a pipe. So pressure bus pipes, how much can go through that network and going through that service is going to be key and critical. When it comes to your BYOD or bring whatever device, you want to make sure that you have training aids and also quick tips and best practices that you share with that Windows user, that iOS, and that Android user, so they can get the optimal experience.
Right, and to add on to that, the typical do's and don'ts: don't have a meeting that you're hosting on a cell phone as you're driving your vehicle down the highway.
Towers.
Right, and the other thing, because the biggest complaints that we hear is somebody's on the edge of that cell for the cell phone, the microwave, and then what happens is their connection starts dropping out, they start breaking up, they start stepping on all over all the other participants in the calls. We also have ones where if they are having a meeting, we recommend that they plug in and try not to use maybe the Wi-Fi. If it's unreliable, say like at a remote facility, we recommend that they plug it in. We also have tips on what type of home routers, Wi-Fi that works best.
How to optimize at your house.
Yep. Right. Yeah, I mean, we have some older devices out there that folks have not updated the BG type access points. We have recommendations of here's like five different access points that you can use that we have tested that give great performance.
Mm-hmm. When you say access points, you mean equipment?
The Wi-Fi routers.
At the end of the day, we can't control the internet. Yeah. And we can't control how our users are using the technology. So like Donna said, we spent a lot of time around educating our users. We created a whole article around how you can set yourself up to have the best experience from home. And some of the things you already touched on, if somebody's running a microwave, that can impact it. Mm-hmm. But we also have a list of approved devices that our team has actually tested rigorously. And all of our users know that these are the devices that are approved, and those are the ones that are in our zones, which is our ordering mechanism for things
like
devices.
Saying headsets, microphones as well.
Yeah, hands-free.
In addition to the access points.
Exactly.
We have a Skype certification program for peripherals, but we also have even more rigor for Microsoft IT that we certify devices for our end users' experience, and we ask, all that helps.
It's really important, and Donna touched on one of the key ones. If one person is doing something on a call, like driving down the street with their window open, doing a conference call, that can trash the entire call. So it's a lot of we do a lot of education with our users to say, hey, one person can actually affect a large call. So we try to really, really educate.
And now the owner of the meeting can mute them. And actually, I've been on calls where they mute everybody because they don't know who's causing it.
Right. And sometimes if we have really, really important meetings, we actually have somebody moderate. So somebody's basically, because the other people are presenting and they don't want to be thinking about it, so there's just somebody watching to see if anybody's breathing heavy or causing
other problems.
Yeah,
we've all been on those calls.
And then quickly mute.
Well, we can't prevent users from using their cell phones. We can't prevent them from having those type of meetings and meetings at home on their laptop, not using an approved device. So what we do is, like you said, we just publish those recommended guidelines, and that's all that we
can try to influence. It's available for external customers.
It's externally available to customers as well.
Even like taking a headset, for example, recently I've done a test of a Bluetooth headset that uses a specific dongle, but usually when a user gets those headsets, they tend to pair that Bluetooth directly with a PC Bluetooth, which doesn't give the optimum, audio quality. Yep. So we have been doing a lot of tests saying, hey, what happens if we pair it directly? What happens if you're using a Bluetooth mouse and a Bluetooth Surface 10 at the same time?
Yep.
All those kind of tests we perform.
And you can put those best practices out to employees.
A great call out, Shin.
Great. So it's not just having the approved device, it's using it properly or as intended.
Think of many ways that users might use that.
Yeah.
And I think what it comes down to, and John, you alluded to, there are things that we can control from an IT perspective, but then there are other things that you can influence. And we do a lot of work to try to influence those best practices. We have, frankly, 220,000 users out there, and not everyone will use our best practice. But, so we focus on just getting the word out and attending as many forums and talking to external customers on how we get that message out so that they can have the best possible Skype for Business meeting experience.
Right, and I know as a user, it's painful to have a bad user meeting experience. So I'm self-motivated to look at those best practices and follow them.
Well, the user just wants it to work.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And they just want it to work right every time, but there are so many variables that contribute to that it is in the end user's behalf to know, especially if you're trying to run a large meeting or consistent meetings and good quality meetings, these best practices so that they can can get the best out of the product
Very
service.
Good. How stable is your iOS client for Skype for Business? Do you have an SLA for defects found when other companies do a patch or update to their OS?
Yes, Skype for Business iOS client is extremely stable. I think the question you're having is what happens when our partner customers or our customer has an issue? And I would say yes, that would depend on you partnering and working with your TAM and what other type of premium support service that you either pay for or have. Our team is primarily focused internal to Microsoft. But if you have customer issues, please engage your TAM, which will engage your Premier support, and then they will turn around with an SLA to you based on your contract. But the net of it is, I do see issues that come through from the customer, and they're logged and backlogged, and we're triaged, and anything that is critical or chronic are pushed to the front of the list to resolve as quickly as possible. But if you're noting things and it's impacting your BYOD program, I would engage your TAM and your Premier support lead.
Yeah, and we have a fairly large population of iPhone users.
One.
Yes,
a mobile one.
I still have my Windows phone, but I'm a bit of a relic there. But we do have a large population, so that allows us to test things ahead of time internally, especially if Apple is going to do some sort of a patch or an upgrade to their phone client. Then we can actually test that internally prior to that going out externally.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Are all your users based on on-premise or in cloud or in hybrid mode? How many front-end server and locations do you have deployed currently?
The answer is yes.
All of the above.
I'll take that one. So we have we're about 50-50 right now as far as how many users work remotely versus work from a Microsoft office. As far as the different environments, we have primarily three different environments. We have on-prem still, and we still have a fairly large user population, although we're quickly migrating them to the cloud right now. We have a hybrid environment in which they get IAM and presence in the cloud, and conferencing and voice is still on-prem. And then we have the full E5 SKU that Dwight talked about earlier, which is full meal deal. You're fully in the cloud. You have voice, conferencing, IAM, presence, everything in the cloud. So I would say it changes day to day because we are migrating people, but we've got roughly 44,000 people in the cloud in those two different environments, the hybrid versus the full voice in the cloud, and probably, I don't know, 80, 90,000 still Dwight on-prem.
Well, we still, I think it's the number's just a little bit higher than that. It's probably about 221,000 users. We have about 50,000 of them that are in that cloud environment, and of that 50,000, around 21,000 are in that full E5, a full voice in the cloud environment. I think that leaves about 171,000, but we're migrating to the cloud environment actively, and our end goal is to have 90% of our users in the cloud by the end of this fiscal year. So it's gonna happen, you know, really quickly. You know, the quality issues from being in the cloud is a much more reliable environment for us. You transfer a lot of the challenges that you have in the on-prem environment from having shared infrastructure and as well as the management overhead of having to manage your own servers. And so to speak to your question, we're basically out of four data centers here, and I think we're running a 12 FE install for each of the data centers. However, you know, our go forward is to move everything. We're a cloud and mobile first company, and we're moving to the cloud for that better experience. And with that said, Microsoft IT, we just become a customer of the cloud. So managing that infrastructure is all done in our dedicated multi-tenant environment. And so we get to see the telemetry from the reliability of the environment and what our user experience is. But you know, and me being a traditional IT manager, it's a lot to let go but I'm seeing the benefits from a better, a more reliable environment as we transition to the cloud.
And frankly, we don't know how many front ends we have in the cloud because of what Dwight was just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk a little bit about the 12 front end configuration that we have. We do that so that we can actually run 100% of our population from one data center. So if we have to fail over to a data center, we need to fail over and run 100% from that disaster recovery failover data center. So that's why we have probably a little bit additional capacity than what some users might, or what some companies might have.
Yeah,
I've heard of leaving a certain subset of users on-prem. Was there any talks of the hybrid as well? Would there be a certain subset of that? Because supporting our customers obviously out there, some still cannot make it to the cloud.
So I think that hybrid's going to be around for a while. Not only from a product perspective, and our primary reason for the 10% in the remaining on-prem is because we're going to continue to support Skype for Business server in that on-prem instance for some time now. So we're going to keep our population there so we can support that. But there are situations and scenarios within Microsoft, depending on the region, that is going to either require the on-prem instance. I think of India with some of the regulatory reasonings there. But as you think globally, there are going to be regional needs for a hybrid scenario because they will not allow the full cloud implementation. So there are going to be a need for all the scenarios, even though the end goal is to get most of the company
to the cloud.
As much as
possible.
Yeah, absolutely. For the gains there.
Absolutely.
We have a follow-up to one of our early questions. The answer to the early question was policies can be changed on the server side to turn off video or throttle video. Mm-hmm. The follow-up question is, which server would the changes need to be made on? Office 365 portal service for Skype, or is there an on-premise server that needs to be modified?
It depends on their type of, was a loud crash behind me. I'm not sure if you heard that.
If you saw us all jump, that's
why. That was server. That
not
was
an
server.
Earthquake, right? Okay. Getting to that question, it depends on what type of environment you're in. If you have some O365 and you have it somewhat on-prem, as far as disabling the video, we tend to promote video IM and presence within the Skype for Business client. If your concerns are your bandwidth, whether it be through maybe your Wi-Fi infrastructure or your WAN type of connections, here what we do is we don't really apply any policies to throttle that and turn features off because we want users to use that feature. But there is a way that you can disable video. You can do it within the client. You can do it within policies. We recommend that if you're going to turn anything off, you do it within the policies. And there's a way to do it within O365, the admin portal pages, or on-prem within your front-end server environment, because that's where your AV MCUs are located.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, I know there's, from an administrative perspective, that we can throttle some of that, mm-hmm. but isn't that built into the product as well to where it does some of the throttling? It recognizes low bandwidth, so in the client?
It does. So we sacrifice frame rate over resolution. So what'll happen is we'll drop frame rate. So you'll get the clear picture, but then if you drop below 15 frames a second, where that means your bandwidth is highly taxed at that point. We'll start dropping frames, but we maintain the audio. You can still do your IM presence, desktop sharing, but you'll start noticing the hit coming to the video portion of that. But yes, the first thing that's always going to take the hit. We have several thousands, 14,000 conference rooms out there.
Yep.
And within specific regions, we have those regions that don't have the larger pipes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in South America, we've seen some issues down there where they can only have specific ISDN dial-up or T1 that's FRAC T1. And what'll end up happening is they will take hits on the video, and we'll get complaints that the video is cutting in and out. And what we typically try to do is see if we can get additional bandwidth into there, but we try not to turn off the video. But like you said, the client is adaptable to that. So there's
H.264.
Right, so it'll take, it'll start like with the H.264, but it'll throttle down through different codecs down to like H.261, which is something that can handle that the limited bandwidth and still get communications across.
It's prioritized audio, so you can keep having the conversation even with the choppy video.
Good. We implement QoS for voice and video, and we have a higher marking.
And
the plans are to roll forward with video markings as well. Everything else goes into a best effort queue, but we prioritize voice. So sometimes we'll see.
So you can still have your conversation.
You can still
if you have low bandwidth.
Right.
And I just want to kind of reiterate, QoS is extremely important when it comes to especially voice quality. And so we use DSCP marking. I think it's 46, which is expedited forwarding. Mm. But we have had issues in the past where, you know, we were at 100% settings across all of our devices, most of our Cisco devices, and all of a sudden, after a while, our voice quality started to dip. And so we did some deep dive analysis, and we found that a number of our devices had actually had what we call configuration drift. So they had lost their QoS settings, and that actually really impacted the voice quality. I had some poor engineer, he had to go out and touch every single Cisco device we have in this company, which is a lot. But now we actually have a monitoring system called HPNA. It's a templatized approach, which allows us to say this is a known good configuration for a Cisco whatever. And if anything falls outside of that, then it'll throw up an exception, and then we can actually monitor it instead of having to go out and, you know, after the fact, touch all those devices. And then we can go remediate it. So it's extremely important. Once we got QoS back under control, our voice quality improved dramatically, actually.
Great. Let's go to next question. Is it possible to bulk import regular Skype contacts into Skype for Business? Bulk import not one by one, and what does the roadmap look like for Skype for Business Online? And what about mobile app improvements? I will just make a quick comment before we ask our SMEs to answer that question. We are Microsoft IT, and we love to talk about how we do IT at Microsoft. We can't always take on the product group questions. With that, bulk import, who's the best?
Yeah, I can do that. We saw the same issue when we went from Link 2013 to 2015, and we were onboarding our Nokia partner at that time. So originally we did have challenges where there was some onesie twosies, but then we partnered with the product group and then we pulled in the bulk. So I would say work with your TAM, work with your technical team to make sure you can make that happen. But
so bulk imports available through special means now?
Mm-hmm.
But okay. And you also talked about with Skype for Business earlier that there's a Skype directory that we already have access to the Skype consumer, you know, and I don't know if I heard the question correctly, but I think they were asking how do you get the Skype consumers, users
Skype into
that
Skype
contact,
for
because we got with the Skype directory,
yeah.
You have all of those users that are there and it's built into the Skype for Business product.
So no import needed?
It might be in their deployment coming from 2013 to 2015.
Yeah.
That's when they'll see the probably onesie twosies and go, but Skype consumer, no. They should just be able to search.
In the same directory, Skype and Skype for Business.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But if you're coming from 13 to Skype for Business Online,
2013.
Link 2013 is Skype for Business Online.
Okay, great. I do want to let our customers know that we have posted, we love your feedback, so we would like to know your thoughts on this session. So when you get a moment, please let us know through the question posted in your window. Next question, do you have mandatory training for Skype before you issue accounts, or do you just expect end users to educate themselves?
They're allowed to create their own accounts.
No, I think when we do a deployment internally, and last April of 2015, when we converted from Link 2013 to Skype for Business, we had expansive training program. We partner not only with product marketing, but to our customer facing and our sales teams and our IT managers. And we rolled out Train the Trainer. We rolled out Work Smart. We worked out productivity guides, or here's how you do it, and here's how you manage some of the features. So no, we do have training programs, and they're ongoing all year long. As we change and modify and evolve the products, we will evolve the documentation and we will reissue training. So there is still Skype for Business training going on as we introduce new features and as we roll out. Even around the mobile client, we put documentation out there, and I think it's
mandatory.
I was going to say nothing mandatory.
Nothing mandatory.
But Donna, didn't you add it to the NEO, the new hire program?
Yes, new hire training.
They get the Skype for Business training as they come on board to Microsoft.
Yes, because we don't want to assume that everyone worked on Microsoft products. Yeah. I didn't have them when I was in NEO. I was like,
So we do have compulsory training. Right? Yeah. We do have required training that we do every year, but Skype for Business is not included in it yet.
Yeah.
But that is a conversation that we're starting to open up around actually having that be part of the mandatory. Some of the mandatory stuff is like business ethics,
compliance,
you know, storing your data in the cloud and doing it in such a way that we're protecting Microsoft's assets. But I would really love to see a Skype for Business compulsory mandatory training.
And I'm gonna jump in here and put a plug. Since Donna mentioned productivity guides, these same guides that we write for Microsoft employees, we make available for you, our customers, out there on IT Showcase, off of Microsoft.com/IT Showcase. So how we get our employees up to speed very quickly, all that information is available for you. So look for it out there on our site.
And we're always creating new ones, so keep checking back.
Yep. And one more plug for our readiness and adoption team, right? We have just launched our readiness and adoption team that is all geared around making sure that all Microsoft users get the latest and greatest content. And along with the sentiment work that we talked about, we have a Skype at Microsoft approach where you know, we want to keep content updated fresh. And I know, Jonathan and Donna, you all contribute to that all the time to make sure that our users get the latest and greatest. And so that readiness and adoption approach is also.
It's basically a portal, but we have a whole team of people that actually focus on making sure that that data or that content is actually updated daily. Because if you put content out there and it gets stale, and we've done that in the past, frankly, they won't consume it. So it has to be fresh. It has to be the latest stuff right off the presses. So
just to pivot off of that, also, you need to have a communication plan. What is that communication plan from deployment and messaging? What functions and features you're going to provide? And then that continual feedback of what's coming, what's next, here's how you use it. Here's some tips, trips, best practice. Here's some things that need to stay top of mind. We use all that through Skype at Microsoft, but there is a thought out and a planned program of when and how often and what's the frequency of communication to the end user and to turn it around and get feedback from them.
Absolutely.
Very good.
One more thing about the user training. We do have a lot of creative IT managers out in the field. Yep. And from my experience, I was an IT manager once, and it was like 7-8 years ago when I tried to deploy. At that time it was OCS. It was an entirely new thing to the end users. What we did was we set up a lot of classroom trainings, and then for the people that joined, you know, receive that training, then we hand out the headsets so that they can start using it.
But that's how they got the headset.
Yes. But it was quite successful. But on the other hand, we found out that some of the users who didn't want to get the training started using them without a proper headset, and that's where we became.
So it wasn't,
You have to balance out, but that was one of the success stories that I had.
Yeah, and we've used Champions approach as well, because I was an IT manager in the field, actually out in Australia for 4 years, and we used like a Champions program as well to the people who were really passionate about it. And they would walk around, and if they saw somebody speaking into their laptop mic and speakers, which we know is not always the best experience, they would go up and talk to that person and say, hey, try this headset. You know, you're going to have a better experience. And it was really effective for us as well.
We're going to move on to the next question.
We like that one.
How do you provision the users to be on the best suitable Skype pool geographically? And in general, how is the user provisioning process look like? Who's the best person for that?
Anybody want to talk about auto prov?
I can't speak to auto provisioning, but I do know that, you know, that we do have regional provisioning, and a lot of it has to deal with the where that user is based out of, and I alluded to it earlier, like in our India deployment, where we have just deployed enterprise voice there. It's a heavily regulated country, and all of their voice data has to be held inside of that country. So we have a specific deployment for them, but generally, all of our other users are either homed out of our Dublin data center, our Singapore data center. We have data centers here in North America, and am I missing a region?
Europe, Middle East, and Africa. Right.
Yeah. So basically, out of four major data centers. But then we talked about also the cloud implementation, where we have our cloud infrastructure, our zero M environment, which takes care of the North America environment, and we're just scaling users to that. But we've just stood up our 1M environment that's going to cover EMEA, and I believe that we're going to also house our APAC environment in that. So that's and we home based off of where that user is out of.
Right. So in the accounts provision, there's like a drop down box within that auto prov that you can select which region. So if somebody's traveling a lot, but they're hosted out of one region, they can actually select the region they're most in. But then again, we've seen in the past where somebody has moved to the U.S. Mm-hmm. and they were from maybe APJ, and then we're starting to see call quality issues, and then we're seeing, they were not moved to the other pool.
We have a great tool.
It's a manual process, but it has.
But we have a tool that helps called Telcat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's called Telcat. That helps us see and identify people who are showing an address that doesn't map to the number that they have. And so we are going to be doing some efforts to try to get those people cleaned up and get them on a more localized number.
And in general, what does the user provisioning process look like?
It's done automatically called auto-provisioning tools. It's look at the HRS database, and they have a home office. Looking at that number, you will assign the numbers automatically, and you will.
Is that homegrown, auto-provisioning? Is it a tool?
I think it's used by product group too.
I don't know if that's available outside of Microsoft.
I don't know if it's available for on-prem.
And so it might be something they could talk to their MCS consultant or TAM about.
Yeah, and it's something that we try to avoid what I used to call the Microsoft IT secret sauce.
Yeah.
We would do these things to make our stuff work better, and then we wouldn't provide it to customers. And so we try not to do that, but we do still have a few
of that out there.
Examples.
But generally make them available if a customer wants to get access to something like that, they can talk to their TAM, and has opportunities within MCS.
MCS is a good route to go.
Yeah.
Okay, a follow-up to that same question, any reason the SMTP and SIP address differ for a Microsoft employee account? Everybody's looking at KC.
They should not.
No, it should be the same.
Typically, they are matched the same.
Yeah.
There are certain ones where they don't, but it should be few and far between, for sure.
I can't think of a reason why.
I can't think of a reason either.
I've seen someone that was mapped to like Bing.com versus a Microsoft address.
Mm-hmm.
So you have those different anomalies.
But live.com meetings, I've seen that.
I'm sorry, we don't have a better answer for that one.
Next question, our last question for the live video. We originally set up a few users on manually on Office 365, but put two of them in my favorites on Skype for Business. Now we've moved to ADFS. One of the users I added to my favorites at the beginning cannot be moved from my favorites. I've been told to re-enable those manual accounts in the admin console, then remove them from my favorites, then disable those manual accounts again. It works for one of the users, but not for the other. Any ideas? That sounds very specific.
That's a very specific question that would need to be troubleshot based on the deployment.
I think it's more of a support-related question.
Yeah.
We need to get them in touch with
Whoever their premier
CSS,
and CSS award is,
Yeah, follow up.
Because it's one of those things we'd have to really
You have to understand
hands-on.
The environment.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a tough one to answer.
So following up with your TAM on that, we have a couple of questions that we'll answer offline and post with the original video. So we are close enough to the end that we need to start wrapping up. I do want to ask our SMEs one final question before we wrap up. And we're going to start with Shin. What is the one tip you would like our customers with us today to leave with from your specific area?
Well, I've been managing a lot of PSTN connectivity for our Skype for Business environment, not just the SBCs, but also the voice media gateways out there. One thing I would be to kind of a key takeaway is that try to design your PSTN interface as an kind of like an N plus one redundant design, because we have seen in the past a lot where we were saved by having that kind of design, you know, and prevent a lot of outages and affecting our internal users. So for example, like voice gateways always have two sets of boxes and multiple circuits coming in. Even though that site might be a small site that can handle with just one PRI circuit, it is the best practice, and it's from our experience that always have that redundant design wherever possible to minimize the user outage of the service.
I guess my one tip would be, and it took some time for me to get there, is that, you know, cloud first. And what I mean by that, as, you know, being a guy that's been in IT for 30 years and I'm used to owning my own systems and having the expertise to manage them, the complexity that we have here at Microsoft really impacts our user experience in that shared IT traditional infrastructure. But as we have migrated to the cloud and transferred our network links to where we don't have to worry about the ACL, VIP, DIP, or routing changes that are happening for some service that may impact our service quality or the capacity of our servers in our environment, being able to transfer that to the cloud where I know I'm going to have the capacity, I know that I'm not going to be disrupted in with my network, that has been a huge gain, and I can't get our users to the cloud fast enough to avoid some of the complexity and challenges that we've had in the shared IT environment.
Kevin?
What I'd like to bring up is, with video, we're seeing more of it coming into the environment. We have several different products coming out this year alone, which add more load onto the network because they're video-based. We're also kind of getting away from the structured cabling and moving more to Wi-Fi. So what I would say is, make sure that as you're rolling out these video and conferencing solutions that your backbone can actually handle that. That goes from the one question with the, you know, turning off that video, and we expanded on that about, you know, maybe perhaps implementing some policies. Look about maybe, you know, what is that capacity going to look like in 4 to 5 years from now if we decide to put more of this over Wi-Fi. Do make sure they, you know, that you do your surveys, that you can handle capacity. Because you got to think about also the, you know, the change in technologies within the devices themselves too. So capacity is key.
Great.
When looking at your deployment, expand it around your bring your own device or BYOD. When you think of your client, don't just think of the desktop. Think of the web app. Think of the three mobile clients, and what is your best practices. Another thing, when allowing BYOD at work. Tie into Intune, multi-factor authorization, understand the security that you're going to have around the use of those devices, and once again, educate your end user on the best tips, behaviors, and practices that you're expecting and looking for as they use those devices to conduct business.
Very good. Jonathan?
Yeah, so my big tip, and this is a big one, is as you prepare to move to the cloud, and we know you're going to move to the cloud, if you're not already, make sure you don't forget your friends in the networking and infrastructure areas. And we were guilty of this ourselves. I'll give you a couple examples. We already touched on the quality of service example. But also, as we did our first migrations to the cloud, and this was actually Exchange, but it applies across all of Office 365, we didn't alert the networking people. And as most people might know, when you migrate, we migrated them on a Friday night, they came back in the office on a Monday, and the minute you fire up your Outlook client, you're going to download all of your email. And it's going to come, you know,
from outside.
Yes, it's going to come from outside. So what we did was we actually had some old firewall technology called ISA firewalls. And they were not prepared to handle that load, and we actually tipped over those firewalls. Mm-hmm. We had actually had a project on the books to move to newer Fortinet technology, and it was going to happen sometime that year. Well, this kind of made us reprioritize that, so we actually had to bring that one forward so that we could continue migrating to the cloud. So you've got to have that be a joint effort with your infrastructure and networking folks, or else you're probably going to have a disaster. Mm-hmm. Also, I should mention, Dwight and I and some others on the team actually took part in a white paper that has it's out there. It's on TechNet, I believe, and it was all around what did we do to prepare not just our services but our infrastructure and networking to get ready to migrate to the cloud. And there's some great information around there around what you know what to do and what not to do. So we'll get that link and we'll put it in along with the recording.
Okay, great. Casey.
Yeah, you can influence Skype for Business product group. There's a website called skypefeedback.com. If you want to have like some feature set which is not available, you can go in and you can enter. Like for example, for me, I like to have like features in Skype for a Business client to block the calls from like specific numbers. If you're spamming your numbers or calling you all the time and you want to block it, I like to have that kind of features. And if you can help me go to that site and then vote for that. Would be great.
Vote for the features and get your friends and colleagues.
And that's a real world scenario.
Are you trying to block me?
So. Yes.
Yeah. Only certain people on the team. Now we act some real world scenario. Yeah. We have people who call Satya our CEO.
Right.
We have people and they bother him. And they are rude and they're mean and things like that. So we do have to block those, but it's a very, very
for now we are blocking from our session border controller. We are looking at the one number blocking it. But it might be a lot better to
absolutely.
Everyone can block some calls. Just like my cell phone can do it right now, so.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, it's time for us to wrap up. If you haven't already, please give us your feedback on how this session went for you. I do want to thank our SMEs for taking time away from your day jobs to come here and talk to our customers. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And I want to thank our customers for joining us today. We truly enjoy the questions and the dialogue and the opportunity to come talk to you about what's on your mind and today for Skype for Business. We have several live events lined up. We hold them regularly, almost weekly. So we hope you join us again and bring your colleagues. And visit us on Microsoft.com/IT Showcase, where you'll find this video posted, as well as lots of rich resources, technical case studies, articles, videos, productivity guides that Donna mentioned to help you be very successful with Microsoft's technology. And with that, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we are back with the extended footage portion of the Skype for Business SME Roundtable. We had a couple more questions that we wanted to address before we adjourn today. The first question is, when will PSTN calling come to Latin America? That is a question we as IT can't really answer. That's more of a product group question, so we're going to have to defer that back to your TAM and to the product groups. Next question, what about split tunnel configuration for remote users? Do you have split tunnel internally, and how did you accomplish that? Dwight?
Yeah, I can speak to it somewhat. Skype for Business and our split tunneling approach are two separate items, and we depend on our networking team, as well as our client services team to handle that. And just to speak a little bit about what split tunneling is and does for our remote access and direct access users, what it allows us to do is to use the public internet when needed versus coming in through your internal infrastructure, or if you need to access corporate resources, then you use direct access or your VPN connection. So we do have it enabled. We leverage it here, but Skype for Business runs over the top of that service. So we can't speak to the direct configuration of that, but we do leverage it here.
Microsoft IT does leverage it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dwight. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.
All right.